Well, good. There are some outlines on your chairs, which you may find helpful. We're going to try and divide the day up into sort of three sections. Really what I'm trying to do here is give you a day's worth of content up until lunchtime. So we're going to see how we go. This is really the fourth in a series of training days that I do all over the place. The first one is a day that explores principles of ministry. We think about how principles of ministry called REAL, which is relational, educational, authentic, and life-changing, how that applies in our local churches, how we run our rotas, how they promote relationship, how they help the children to learn, how we structure our class, all those sorts of things. We try and think those things through theologically. In the afternoon on that first day, we spend a whole afternoon just unpacking a Bible text. In day two, we spend a lot of time thinking through child development, so that we are making sure that we connect with children at their various stages as they're growing up. We spend the afternoon thinking through how to teach tough passages where there's blood, sex, violence, blood being spattered all over the place. How do you go about teaching that to three-year-olds? Do you do it? How do you do it? We think about how to teach the Old Testament in a way that points them to Jesus, so we're not just teaching it as a Jewish history book. In day three is called Engage. We spend some time thinking through how to engage the heart. So we are deliberately making application. We're not just telling Bible stories, but we are actually giving children take-home value. They've got to have engaged in their hearts with the truth that we're trying to teach them. We talk about engaging. We spend some time engaging boys. How do you get hold of boys? How do you connect with them? How do you engage them deliberately in the learning process? And we talk about engaging hostility. I don't know about you, but I'm finding increasingly the children who come to our Sunday school are living in a very hostile environment. There's snide remarks being passed by teachers at school with regards to the Christian faith. They really ought not to be doing it. Someone really should be telling them off, but they're not. And I'm finding that I've got to try and equip my kids as young as five with how to combat this hostility that they're getting and how to counter it in some way. And then what we're trying to do this morning really is to do what is essentially day four, trying to spend some time thinking through creative ways in which we can tell stories. Now, generally, the way we write our mustard seeds material, some of you may be familiar with that material, we generally say that you're doing basic Bible study with children 8 and above, and you're doing storytelling with children under 8. So we want to tell stories in a helpful way, but if you're teaching older children, then I think today's helpful as well, because it helps us to think and engage with biblical narrative. And that's what we're trying to do in this first session. We're trying to think about how do we engage with narrative as narrative. We don't do enough work on that. We don't do enough work often of thinking through things like plot and character development and all that sort of thing. Very helpful to get these principles in place even when you're putting a Bible study together, that you can understand where the climax is, where you're working towards in terms of your presentation and in terms of your navigation through the text. Now, the reality is that we all love stories. There's no doubt about that. We all love all kinds of different stories. There's so many novels and films and plays and biographies and autobiographies and histories of peoples and cultures and travel journals. I mean, there's just millions of books, aren't there? We love stories. When the iPad was originally launched, just look how clunky that thing looks now. When it was originally launched, they sold 2 million units in the first 60 days, and those 2 million units downloaded 5 million books. Some more, 2.5 books each per unit, because we love stories. And there is great power in a story. There's great power in a story because it is such a powerful conveyor of ideas. And it's a conveyor of ideas, whether they be good ideas or bad ideas. The power of the story conveys ideas. In fact, so powerful are stories that they are able to engage your heart and mind and make you think in a way which is counter-conscience. Just think about it for a moment. My wife and I love House. I don't know if you're familiar with the series House. There were two consecutive episodes that really struck me. The one was where the young doctor featured over there, Chase, switched the lab results of an African dictator who, if they had healed him, if they had made him well, would have gone back to commit genocide in his country. So he switched the lab results so that he got the wrong treatment to ensure his death. House, the main doctor, knew about this, didn't report him or do anything, but made him feel really bad about what he'd done, and basically said, look, it was a wrong thing to do. You have, in one sense, played God. You have taken someone's life. In the very next episode, his friend, that's Wilson on the right over there, the oncologist, has just basically helped one of his patients commit suicide. He's been an assisted suicide, which was quite well assisted. And their house is arguing that actually it was a merciful thing to do. So in two episodes, guys who have done essentially the same thing, he's twisting you. And the problem is that your heartstrings are tugged. And so you start thinking counter-conscience. You start thinking counter your own morality. Just think of all those Hollywood romance films. Think of the woman, the poor woman, who's married to a guy who's not that interested in her. And he's portrayed as a bit of an idiot, really. And there's such a lovely guy at the office. He's always willing to listen. Of course, he's conveniently much better looking than the husband, isn't he? Always the case. And you find yourself willing the affair. You sort of think, oh, well, they would be much better together, wouldn't they? So that's the power of the story. It has the power to make us think and in a way that is counter-conscious. It's able to carry us along. It's very powerful. It's a two-edged sword, really. It has the ability to counteract boredom because it gets people involved. It gets them moving along. It gets people drawn into the story. But at the same time, if it is not teaching the big idea in the text, the main thrust of the Bible passage, we can find ourselves teaching error. That is one of the biggest problems with people who are good in terms of their oratory skills, is that they can win people and teach error. Now, we don't want to tell Bible stories in a way that makes us teach error. We always want to teach Bible stories in a way that is in line with the big idea or the thrust of the text. One of the big problems with postmodernism is it has pushed what I would call the marginal reading of the text. So a marginal reading of the text means we pick up one little detail in the text and that becomes the big issue. Okay? Let me give an example from real life of picking up on a marginal little detail and making that the big issue. So we had to switch bank accounts in our charity because our current bank wouldn't give us digital banking. So we switched to a bank which will remain unnamed. But if you need to pay us ever, you'll find out who they are. And I couldn't get it to work. It was all set up and I would log on and I wasn't able to transact. I was only able to see statements. I wasn't able to pay people. It was a disaster. 5 weeks of phone calls. At one point, an hour long conversation in conversation with five managers at this particular bank. No one can figure out the problem. Eventually someone said to me, Mr. Bell, the problem is that you're logged in as a signatory, but you're not logged in as one of the trustees. If you were logged in as one of the trustees, then you'd be able to do everything. I said, are you sure about that? She said, absolutely sure about that. That's absolutely right. I said, okay, just give me a minute. All right, I'm logged in as the chairman of our organization, who's a trustee, and still not working. Is he there with you? No. How did you log in? Well, I've got his card, I've got his PIN. I need to be showing him how this works. I've got to show him how it works. He's not very digital, he's more sort of analog. Okay? Explosion. Fraud! I said, you're not listening. How I logged in and whether he's here or not is the marginal issue here. The big issue is that I've spent 5 weeks and you've said to me that this will work. And guess what? It doesn't work. You're missing the whole point here. Let it be on my head. It's absolutely fine. Okay? So that's a marginal, you see what I'm saying? We pick up on a small detail and that becomes the big issue. And sometimes when you hear these arguments going around in terms of so-called same-sex marriage and all that kind of stuff, it's the marginal thing, isn't it? They pick up on a small detail and that becomes the big issue. Rather than understanding the whole thrust of the Bible as a whole. So we've got to make sure that we are doing that. When we are teaching the Bible, we are teaching the Bible in a way that is consistent with the big idea or the main thrust of the passage. And that will avoid the situation where we are telling children, we are majoring on minor issues in the particular text. So for instance, a lot of our material is being translated into Arabic, and the guy doing the work said, at first he thought to himself, why should he bother translating work Why doesn't he just use what's already available in the Arab world? And so they found some Sunday school material already in Arabic and just picked up one lesson to compare that lesson with our lesson. And it was the story of Miriam placing Moses in the basket and sending him down the Nile. You know the story. Of course, the Arabic material had said the whole point of that story was to teach that children should obey their parents. Miriam obeyed her mother. Moses was safe. If you obey your parents, that's a good thing. Now, that's not the main thrust of the passage, is it? It's not the main thrust at all. What was happening? Well, we had a murderous king trying to get rid of boys 2 years and under. And guess what? Granted, through the obedience of Moses' mother and his sister, God rescued the one who would eventually rescue his people. It's amazing that a few thousand years later, there was another murderous king trying to kill boys 2 and under. And through the obedience of Mary and Joseph, what happened? God again rescued the one who would rescue his people. You see, that's a much bigger truth. It's a much bigger truth to teach children about the sovereignty of God. And in this particular instance, the sovereignty of God in salvation, rather than telling them that they should obey their parents and to be using the Bible to do that. So are we clear on this whole idea of a marginal reading of the text? Take this little insignificant detail and that becomes the overriding thing that drives the whole understanding of the text. Let's think about the Bible as a story. The Bible is a book. It's a collection of books. It's a collection of 66 books, in fact, by at least 40 authors in 3 different languages, written on 3 continents, and over a period of 1,600 years, and more than 40% of it is narrative. That is absolutely astonishing. We do not have anywhere in the world a piece of literature like this. Nowhere. There is no religious writing in the world that even comes close to the Bible. In terms of its span, in terms of its theme content, in terms of its continuity, in terms of its internal unity, it is absolutely astounding. The Quran doesn't even come close. The most complete story in the Quran could possibly be conceived to be the story of Joseph, which is probably nicked from the Bible anyway. Yeah? Otherwise, it's incoherent. It's inconsistent. Okay? And written by one man. Now, you take all of these factors into account and you say to yourself, this is astonishing. This is divine. This is inspired by God. It's been overseen by God from beginning to end. And it is a complete story. It begins in a garden. It ends in a city. And there's a tree in the beginning and there's a tree at the end. And it's all about relationships. And it's all about God's people living in God's place under God's rule. And what that looked like throughout history and what it will look like at the end. It's wonderfully, wonderfully coherent as literature. That's the Bible. And so we need to think about the Bible in terms of being a story. There is a unifying plot in the Bible. It's got a brilliant plot line. All the threads get tied together all the way through and eventually everything's tied together at the end. Someone has said recently to me that the plot of the Bible is basically kill the dragon, get the girl. That's brilliant, isn't it? Kill the dragon, Satan, get the girl, the bride of Christ. It's brilliant. It's exactly what the Bible's about. Let's think about the purpose of a Bible. The Bible is not just to provide a history of the people of Israel. The Bible is not just there for it to be some light bedtime reading. Well, the book of Judges is certainly not light bedtime reading, is it? No, what's the purpose of the Bible? The purpose of the Bible is to reveal God to us, to make God known. Now, God obviously reveals himself in different ways. He reveals himself in creation. So the world around us, the observable world around us, we can know something about God from that. So Psalm chapter 19 verse 1 says that the heavens declare the glory of God. As we look up into a night sky, we see evidence of a creator God. There is glory there. There is magnificence there. Romans chapter 1 puts it in this way. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. And so it's ironic, isn't it? God's invisible qualities are clearly seen. His divine nature, his power, his majesty are clearly seen in the world around us. So that's one way in which God makes himself known. So we can know certain things about God by just looking at creation. But it only goes so far. And that's why we need the Bible. Because the Bible is a far more deliberate way in which God has made himself known. And we must be very careful that we don't just think of the Bible as man's observations of what's going on in the world. That we don't just think of the Bible as being a history of the people of Israel. Because it is so much more than that. I came across this verse in Amos chapter 3 verse 7 that says, "Surely the sovereign Lord does nothing without revealing his plan to his servants the prophets." Just think about that verse. The sovereign Lord who can do anything he wants in the world, who does not need to consult with anybody in the world in terms of what he does because he is sovereign. What does he do? He does nothing without first revealing his plan to his servants, the prophets. What we are talking about here is that the Bible is not just a history book. It's not just people observing the world around them and trying to interpret history. This is not Norse mythology. You know, Norse mythology heard the rumbling of thunder and thought, oh, well, let's make up a story to go with it. Must be Thor playing with his hammer. That's not what we see in the Bible. What we see in the Bible is what we would call propositional revelation. God tells us what he's going to do, and then he does it. You see that throughout the Bible. In fact, he tells us what's going to happen hundreds of years down the line. The story of Exodus. That's not just a change in political fortunes. God has promised that that would be happen. He promised that to Abraham. He said to him, "Your descendants will be captive in Egypt. They will be captive for 400 years and then I will release them." And the story of Babylon's captivity as well. He also said, "They will be captive for 70 years and then I will release them." So God tells us what he's going to do, and then he does it. It's an interpreted history. It's not just an observed history. Does that make sense to you? Okay? Propositional revelation. God is making himself known. He tells us what he's going to do, and then he does it. And finally, God reveals himself in the person of Jesus. Jesus is the perfect, fullest, final revelation of God. It's the way that God ultimately makes himself known. And so Hebrews chapter 1 verse 1 to 2 says, "In the past God spoke to our ancestors through prophets at many times and in various ways, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son." It goes on to say that the Son is the exact representation of God's being. Like a signet ring pushed into hot wax, molten wax, and you pull it out and you get the exact representation. So Jesus is the exact representation of God's being. The disciples say to Jesus, "Show us the Father." Jesus says, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." Okay? Don't need to see anything more. Okay? He is the exact representation. You want to know what God is like? Well, we don't have to guess. Every other religion in the world is guessing what God is like. Not so? Go and sit on a high mountain and gaze at your navel and try and think about what God is like. You get people who say, "Oh, well, I like to think about God as..." Well, I don't really care how you like to think about God, to be fair. Because my thinking about God might be different, and then which one's right? Thankfully, we have an objective reality. We have the person of Jesus. I can know exactly what God is like. I don't have to guess. I can know what God hates. I can know what God loves by looking at the person of Jesus. And so as I get to know Jesus more, as he literally walks off the pages of the New Testament, I get to know what God is like. Not complicated, actually. But sometimes the God that's being revealed is a little bit inconvenient. Because we've all matured and we've grown beyond this God. Not so. This God's a little bit egocentric, wanting glory for himself. We're much better than that today, aren't we? We don't quite like that kind of God. He's a God who judges sin. Oh, well, that just sounds vindictive. We don't like that God too much. And so we recreate God in our own image. That's the problem. So God reveals himself through the scriptures. He reveals himself through creation, in the Bible, and ultimately in the person of Jesus. And of course, to know what Jesus is like, we've got to go back to the scriptures. So do you understand why the Bible is so important? Why, if we're going to form an opinion about God, it's got to be an opinion that's based on the Bible. And as we teach these stories, we're not just teaching stories. We are teaching children about the character of God through those stories. We'll talk more about what that means a bit later. Now, we're going to spend some time looking at principles quickly, and then preparation and presentation. And normally in a day like today, if we had more time, we'd spend a whole afternoon workshopping those ideas. I am going to break you into groups in a little while, and we'll spend some time exercising what we're learning as we go along. Different kinds of stories. I get this from a book by Christopher Booker called Seven Basic Plots, Why We Tell Stories. Now, he's already done all the work for us. He has spent 35 years exploring stories from all over the world, different cultures, different languages. He's just spent 35 years reading stories. And what he's tried to do is he's tried to categorize the stories in terms of their basic plot. What is the basic plot of the story? Now, there may well be twists in a plot, but he's just saying the basic structure, what is common to all of these, and how are they different? Okay, and he's come up with what he calls seven basic plots. There are no more. There's only seven kinds of stories. Well, so says Christopher Booker. Okay, I'm not going to argue with him because I don't have 35 years to refute him. Okay. Besides, I'm more of an engineer. I like bullet points. I'm not really into long stories. Okay. So, let's think about this. The first one he gives us is he talks about overcoming the monster. That's where you're defeating some force that threatens. So examples in your Hollywood films would be your Star Wars, James Bond. If you had to represent that graphically, it might be a horizontal line that's being broken through. So there's an arrow coming up from below, and it's breaking through. There's a force that is threatening, that's oppressing, and what happens? There is a breakthrough. Overcoming the monster. In a moment, I'm going to give you an exercise to do. We're going to run through a whole lot of Bible stories, and you've got to identify the plot line of each. Okay? The second one is called the quest. So typically, a group set off in search of something, and they usually find it. It may be something like Pilgrim's Progress or Indiana Jones. If you had to represent that graphically, it's simply a linear line. I suppose lines are always linear, aren't they? It's just a line. Okay, it's got a starting point. It's a horizontal line. That's what I meant to say. It's a horizontal line. It's got a starting point and it's got an ending point. It's a quest. Okay, the bulk of the story is taken up with the journey, and then it's resolved quite quickly at the end when they discover what they were looking for. There's the voyage and return. Normally some sort of hero type character journeys away from home to somewhere totally different, and comes back having experienced something that makes them change in some way, in terms of their character, etc. So perhaps Gulliver's Travel, Wizard of Oz, Lord of the Rings. In the Wizard of Oz, every single one of those characters is changed by the experience, not so? They come back different. If I had to represent that graphically, it would be a line going up and coming straight back down. So the idea there really is that it's an inverted V, and you've got a starting point, you've got the experience at the top, and then you've got the ending point, which is different. It's displaced, isn't it? It's different. Okay. Comedy. This is not sort of ha-ha comedy. It's more sort of classical comedy, in the sense that there is some sort of ignorance that keeps two parties apart, and eventually it's resolved at the end. Notting Hill, Pride and Prejudice, all those sort of rom-coms, which I absolutely detest. But anyway, it's a U-shape, isn't it? It's this long way around to get to that point when I, as an engineer, know that the quickest point is from there to there. I could sort Pride and Prejudice out in 5 minutes. Yeah. You know what the sad thing is about that? Is that is that we were watching the Hollywood version, and now my daughter's doing studies for her GCSEs, and she's doing the BBC version of it. I mean, Chris, go from 3 hours to six. Anyway, I've got to endure that. I do, because I get to watch Jason Bourne films every single year on three or four consecutive nights, starting at my birthday every single year. So that's my trade-off. Okay, now we're talking real stories. Okay, so do you get the idea about what a comedy is like? Okay, so there's constant obstructions, constant things in the way. You think it's about to be resolved, and just as it's about to be resolved, oof, we're off in another direction again. And you think it's going to be resolved over there, and then off we are in another direction. And eventually, after much time and money and energy has been spent and wasted, we find the result. Tragedy. As it suggests, someone in the story is trapped in some way. Maybe they're tempted, maybe there's vanity, maybe there's greed. They become increasingly ensnared, and very often they die in the end, or it's a terribly, terribly unhappy ending. Or if it's Hollywood, of course, they're okay at the end. So it's a tragedy, it's just a downward line. It starts off very, very well, and ends very, very badly. So perhaps Hamlet, Devil's Advocate, those sorts of films. There's a rebirth story. A rebirth is where the hero is captured or oppressed, seems to be in a state of living death until it all seems lost, and then miraculously they are freed or brought back to life in some way. So, you know, Snow White, every single one of your Die Hard films, there are a lot of them now, aren't there? I mean, they just sort of go on and on and on and on. But it's the classic V-shape. And it's more than just a V-shape. It's more like a tick, isn't it? So it starts off over there. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And that sort of seems to be the turning point at the bottom. And then it gets much better. And often the ending is much better than the beginning. So things end much better than when they started. A rebirth story. It's a classic. Job would be a classic story in the Bible, if you take Job as a whole, of being a rebirth story. Rags to riches story, final one, is exactly as it suggests. Okay, someone is in an absolutely desperate situation. That's how the story starts. And by the end of it, they are in riches. So it's exactly the opposite of a tragedy. It starts off really badly at the bottom, and by the end of it, it's absolutely magnificent. So Cinderella and all 27,000 Hollywood derivatives of that particular theme. Right. Everybody clear on these seven plots? Booker goes as far as to say that these plots are latent in our consciences as human beings. Okay? It's quite a serious claim. He says we watch films anticipating the plot because it's latent to us. And he says that the whole trick of Hollywood and all these places is to try and twist the plot in some way, because most of it is so boringly predictable. Because you've only got these seven categories in your head, how do we twist this plot? How do we change the plot in order to shock you, in order to surprise you? And it's quite hard to do, isn't it? It's quite hard to do. So let's, any comments on that before we quickly do an exercise? Any comments? Okay. Yeah, Sarah.
Would there be a problem with saying that?
Would there be a problem with saying?
Would
there be a problem with saying that we are hardwired? I don't think there's a problem with that, because I actually think it reflects a storytelling God. Yeah. I think he's coming from a totally secular perspective, but I'm saying, yeah, that makes sense. God tells stories. He's a storyteller. He arranges history. He organizes events. And so I think, yeah, I think we are like that by nature. Yeah. Okay. Right. What we're going to do now is, there's a page there which has got a little exercise. And you've got a whole bunch of Bible stories there. And we're quickly going to break into, well, we're not going to break into groups this time round. We'll do that later on. But what we can do is just around you where you are, in twos or threes, could you quickly go through all those Bible passages that are listed there? I've sort of written what the stories are. And if you could categorize them in one of seven, in one of those seven different plots, if there's one that really doesn't fit, then maybe you can highlight that. It may not be necessarily one plot. It may be a merge of two in some way. But normally, roughly, it fits into one of those seven. Okay, we're going to do that. Let's just do that for 10 minutes. It shouldn't take long. Give that a go.